Chapter 71. Sharpshooters, wintry morning, looking with dull eyes and sallow face upon the neighborhood of Leicester Square, finds its inhabitants unwilling to get out of bed. Many of them are not early risers at the brightest of times, being birds of night who roost when the sun is high, and are wide awake, and keen for prey, when the stars shine out. Behind dingy blind and curtain, in upper story and garret, skulking more or less under false names, false hair, false titles, false jewelry, and false histories, a colony of brigands lie in their first sleep. Gentlemen of the Green Bay Road who could discourse from personal experience of foreign galleys and home treadmills, spies of strong governments that eternally quake with weakness and miserable fear, broken traitors, cowards, bullies, gamesters, shufflers, swindlers, and false witnesses, some not unmarked by the branding iron beneath their dirty braid, all with more cruelty in them than was in Nero, and more crime than is in Newgate. For howsoever bad the devil can be in fustian or smock frock, and he can be very bad in both, he is a more designing, callous, and intolerable devil when he sticks a pin in his shirt front, calls himself a gentleman, backs a card or color, plays a game or so of billiards, and knows a little about bills and promissory notes than in any other form he wears. And in such form Mr. Bucket shall find him, when he will, still pervading the tributary channels of Leicester Square. But the wintry morning wants him not, and wakes him not. It wakes Mr. George of the shooting gallery and his familiar. They arise, roll up and stow away their mattresses. Mr. George, having shaved himself before a looking glass of minute proportions, then marches out, bare-headed and bare-chested, to the pump in the little yard and anon comes back shining with yellow soap, friction, drifting rain, and exceedingly cold water. As he rubs himself upon a large jack towel, blowing like a military sort of diver just come up, his hair curling tighter and tighter on his sunburnt temples the more he rubs it, so that it looks as if it never could be loosened by any less coercive instrument than an iron rake, or a curry comb as he rubs, and puffs, and polishes, and blows, turning his head from side to side the more conveniently to excoriate his throat, and standing with his body well bent forward, to keep the wet from his martial legs, Phil, on his knees lighting a fire, looks round as if it were enough washing for him to see all that done, and sufficient renovation. For one day to take in the superfluous health his master throws off. When Mr. George is dry, he goes to work to brush his head with two hard brushes at once, to that unmerciful degree that Phil, shouldering his way round the gallery in the act of sweeping it, winks with sympathy. This chafing over, the ornamental part of Mr. George's toilet is soon performed. He fills his pipe, lights it, and marches up and down smoking, as his custom is, while Phil, raising a powerful odor of hot rolls and coffee, prepares breakfast. He smokes gravely, and marches in slow time. Perhaps this morning's pipe is devoted to the memory of Gridley in his grave. And so, Phil, says George of the shooting gallery after several turns in silence, you were dreaming of the country last night? Phil, by the by, said as much in a tone of surprise as he scrambled out of bed. Yes, governor. What was it like? I hardly know what it was like, governor, said Phil, considering. How did you know it was the country? On account of the grass, I think, and the swans upon it, says Phil after further consideration. What were the swans doing on the grass? They was a-eating of it, I expect, says Phil. The master resumes his march, and the man resumes his preparation of breakfast. It is not necessarily a lengthened preparation, being limited to the setting forth of very simple breakfast requisites for two, and the broiling of a rasher of bacon at the fire in the rusty grate, but as Phil has to sidle round a considerable part of the gallery for every object he wants, and never brings two objects at once, it takes time under the circumstances. At length the breakfast is ready. Phil announcing it. Mr. George knocks the ashes out of his pipe on the hob, stands his pipe itself in the chimney corner, and sits down to the meal. When he has helped himself, Phil follows suit, sitting at the extreme end of the little oblong table, and taking his plate on his knees. Either in humility, or to hide his blackened hands, or because it is his natural manner of eating. The country, says Mr. George, plying his knife and fork. Why, I suppose you never clapped your eyes on the country, Phil. I see the marshes once, says Phil, contentedly eating his breakfast. What marshes? The marshes, Commander, returns Phil. Where are they? I don't know where they are, says Phil, but I see 'em, Governor. They was flat. And miced. Governor and Commander are interchangeable terms with Phil, expressive of the same respect and deference, and applicable to nobody but Mr. George. I was born in the country, Phil. Was you indeed, Commander? Yes. And bred there. Phil elevates his one eyebrow, and after respectfully staring at his master to express interest, swallows a great gulp of coffee, still staring at him. There's not a bird's note that I don't know, says Mr. George. Not many an English leaf or berry that I couldn't name. Not many a tree that I couldn't climb, yet if I was put to it. I was a real country boy, once. My good mother lived in the country. She must have been a fine old lady, Governor, Phil observes. Aye. And not so old either, 35 years ago, says Mr. George. But I'll wager that at 90 she would be near as upright as me, and near as broad across the shoulders. Did she die at 90, Governor? Inquires Phil. No. Bosh. Let her rest in peace, God bless her, says the trooper. What set me on about country boys, and runaways, and good-for-nothings? You, to be sure. So you never clapped your eyes upon the country marshes and dreams excepted. Eh? Phil shakes his head. Do you want to see it? And no, I don't know as I do, particular, says Phil. The town's enough for you, eh? Why, you see, Commander, says Phil, I ain't acquainted with anything else, and I doubt if I ain't a getting too old to take to novelties. How old are you, Phil? Asks the trooper, pausing as he conveys his smoking saucer to his lips. I'm something with a 8 in it, says Phil. It can't be 80. Nor yet 18. It's betwixt 'em, somewheres. Mr. George, slowly putting down his saucer without tasting its contents, is laughingly beginning, why, what the deuce, Phil, when he stops, seeing that Phil is counting on his dirty fingers. I was just 8, says Phil, agreeable to the parish calculation, when I went with the tinker. I was sent on a errand, and I see him a-sittin' under a old building with a fire all to himself worry comfortable, and he says, would you like to come along a-me, my man? ... I says yes, ... and him and me, and the fire goes home to Clerkenwell together. That was April Fool Day. I was able to count up to 10. And when April Fool Day come round again, I says to myself, now, old chap, you're 1 and a 8 in it. ... April Fool Day after that, I says, now, old chap, you're 2 and a 8 in it. ... In course of time, I come to 10 and a 8 in it. 2 10s and a 8 in it. When it got so high, it got the upper hand of me, but this is how I always know there's a 8 in it. Ah. Says Mr. George, resuming his breakfast. And where's the tinker? Drink put him in the hospital, Governor, and the hospital put him in a glass case, I have heard, Phil replies mysteriously. By that means you got promotion? Took the business, Phil? Yes, Commander, I took the business. Such as it was. It wasn't much of a beat round Saffron Hill, Hatton Garden, Clerkenwell, Smithfield, and their poor neighborhood, where they uses up the kettles till they're past mending. Most of the tramping tinkers used to come and lodge at our place. That was the best part of my master's earnings. But they didn't come to me. I weren't like him. He could sing 'em a good song. I couldn't. he could play a May tune on any sort of pot you please, so as it was iron or block tin. I never could do nothing with a pot, but mend it, or bile it never had a note of music in me. Besides, I was too ill-looking, and their wives complained of me. They were mighty particular. You would pass muster in a crowd, Phil, says the trooper with a pleasant smile. No, governor, returns Phil, shaking his head. No, I shouldn't. I was passable enough when I went with the tinker, though nothing to boast of then. But what with blowing the fire with my mouth when I was young, and spiling my complexion, and singeing my hair off, and swallowing the smoke, and what with being naturally unfortunate in the way of running against hot metal and marking myself by such means, and what with having turn-ups with the tinker as I got older, almost whenever he was too far gone in drink, which was almost always my beauty was queer, worry queer, even at that time. As to since, what with a dozen years in a dark forge, where the men was given to larking, and what with being scorched in a accident at a gasworks, and what with being blowed out of winder case filling at the firework business, I am ugly enough to be made a show on. Resigning himself to which condition with a perfectly satisfied manner, Phil begs the favor of another cup of coffee. While drinking it, he says, it was after the case-filling blow-up when I first see you, Commander. You remember? I remember, Phil. You were walking along in the sun. Crawling, Governor, again a wall, true, Phil shouldering your way on, in a nightcap, exclaims Phil, excited. In a nightcap and hobbling with a couple of sticks, cries Phil, still more excited. With a couple of sticks. When you stops, you know, cries Phil, putting down his cup and saucer, and hastily removing his plate from his knees, and says to me, what, comrade? You have been in the wars. Apostrophe I didn't say much to you, commander, then, for I was took by surprise, that a person so strong and healthy and bold as he was, should stop to speak to such a limping bag of bones as I was. But you says to me, says you, delivering it out of your chest as hearty as possible, so that it was like a glass of something hot, what accident have you met with? You have been badly hurt. What's amiss, old boy? Cheer up, and tell us about it. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cheer up. I was cheered already. I says as much to you, you says more to me, I says more to you, you says more to me, and here I am, Commander. Here I am, Commander, cries Phil, who has started from his chair, and unaccountably begun to sidle away. If a mark's wanted, or if it will improve the business, let the customers take aim at me. They can't spoil my beauty. I'm all right. Come on. If they want a man to box at, let 'em box at me. Let 'em knock me well about the head. I don't mind. If they want a lightweight, to be throwed for practice, Cornwall, Devonshire, or Lancashire, let 'em throw me. They won't hurt me. I have been throwed, all sorts of styles, all my life. With this unexpected speech, energetically delivered and accompanied by action illustrative of the various exercises referred to, Phil squat shoulders his way round three sides of the gallery, and abruptly tacking off at his commander, makes a butt at him with his head, intended to express devotion to his service. He then begins to clear away the breakfast. Mr. George, after laughing cheerfully, and clapping him on the shoulder, assists in these arrangements and helps to get the gallery into business order. That done, he takes a turn at the dumbbells, and afterwards weighing himself and opining that he is getting too fleshy, engages with great gravity in solitary broadsword practice. Meanwhile, Phil has fallen to work at his usual table, where he screws and unscrews, and cleans, and files, and whistles in two small apertures, and blackens himself more and more, and seems to do and undo everything that can be done and undone about a gun. Master and man are at length disturbed by footsteps in the passage, where they make an unusual sound, denoting the arrival of unusual company. these steps, advancing nearer and nearer to the gallery, bring into it a group at first sight scarcely reconcilable with any day in the year, but the 5th of November. It consists of a limp and ugly figure carried in a chair by two bearers, and attended by a lean female with a face like a pinched mask, who might be expected immediately to recite the popular verses commemorative of the time when they did contrive to blow old England up alive, but for her keeping her lips tightly and defiantly closed as the chair is put down. At which point the figure in it gasping, "Oh Lord! Oh, dear me! I am shaken!" asks, "How do you, my dear friend, how do you?" Mr. George then descries, in the procession, the venerable Mr. Smallweed out for an airing, attended by his granddaughter Judy as bodyguard. "Mr. George, my dear friend," says Grandfather Smallweed, removing his right arm from the neck of one of his bearers, whom he has nearly throttled coming along, "how do you? You're surprised to see me, my dear friend." "I should hardly have been more surprised to have seen your friend in the city," returns Mr. George. "I am very seldom out," pants Mr. Smallweed. "I haven't been out for many months. It's inconvenient and it comes expensive. But I longed so much to see you, my dear Mr. George. How do you, sir?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.